You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay-Green 1-cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
How's it going, cultist dudes? Come on, you knew it was only a matter of time before we did this one. An iconic 80s cult classic such as this? We'd be crazy to leave it out. That's right, this month we'll be hopping on board our nearest phone booth, traversing the circuits of history, listening to some most excellent music, and generally fucking about in time, as we take a look at the slice of 80s awesomeness that is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I'm DK, your fellow traveller to the past, but always, I'm not alone. I've got a full house with me this time around, so the phone booth's getting pretty ripe. Allow me to say, hello, San Dimas. Please welcome, for the final report of the afternoon, from all throughout history, some of the greatest people who have ever lived in their 2025 world tour. Oh, well, our guests anyway. First up, we have my semi-regular on these cult classics. He turned up last month and, well, he just plain refused to leave. He's the old guard of this podcast network, the one who keeps everything together, sort of. He's Rufus, if Rufus came from Northumberland and didn't play guitar. It's Mr. Mike Wilson.
Greetings, my excellent friends.
So you're ready to go on this one, yeah?
Oh, yeah, I'm always ready to talk Bill and Ted, especially Excellent Adventure.
Next up, we've got a regular guest that you may have heard on last season's Highlander episode, and if not, go back and check it out. I guarantee it's much better than watching the sequels. She's been with us for quite a while on silver screen. Rock chick that she is, allow me to present Rammstein's greatest fan. It's Angela.
Feeling bodacious, my dudes.
And how are we on this fine summer's eve?
Most excellent.
You jumped at the chance to come on this one. I take it this one holds some special memories for you too.
Absolutely. It's one of the films I loved watching when I was growing up, not to sound too old. It's got music in that I like, as do the sequels.
Yeah, finally. We've got another refugee from the Highlander episode last season. He's moved down through time to be with us today, and just like an immortal, he's an artist, graphic designer, who did the very credits of the show you're watching if you're on YouTube, and he's a singer. In fact, if you check out his SoundCloud, you'll see he's a one-man Wild Stallions. It's Ian.
All we are is dust in the wind, dude.
What have you been up to recently? Anything decent?
Recording more songs and sort of working on another music video as well, in my free time when I can.
Nice. Now we've got the guests, we'll get this show on the road. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, a 1989 American science fiction comedy film directed by Stephen Herrick and written by Chris Matheson and Ed Solomon. The first installment of the Bill and Ted franchise. It stars Keanu Reeves, Alex Winter and George Carlin. Follows Bill, Winter and Ted Reeves, who travel through time to assemble historical figures for their high school history presentation. The film was shot on a budget of $8.5 million over a period of 10 weeks, including 2 weeks in Italy, as Herrick was going after the same comedic approach to history as in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. They brought in its production designer, Roy Forge Smith, for this film. Principal filming was shot in the Phoenix, Arizona and Tempe, Arizona metropolitan areas, and many scenes were filmed in and around Scottsdale's Coronado High School. The picture had been planned for a 1988 release, and filming and production had completed on schedule. However, the original film distributor, DEG, fell into significant debt in late 87, and by 88 had filed for bankruptcy. At this point, the film was in post-production, and Herrick attempted to show around the rough cut to other distributors. Herrick said many of these companies were confused, asking him, "Are there kids that really speak like this?" On seeing the film, however, the cut had an extremely popular reaction from a test audience of volunteers pulled from local malls, which led to a small bidding war from production companies to get the title. Some of the former DG execs ended up at Nelson Entertainment, and along with Orion Pictures were able to secure new distribution rights for the film by 88 for about $1 million. The film finally had its theatrical release on February the 17th, 1989, and received mixed to positive reviews. It was considered a modest box office success, grossing $40 million against that just under $10 million budget, with Winter and Reeves reprising their roles in two later sequels, 91's Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey and 2020's Bill and Ted Face the Music. The original movie is now considered a cult classic. And as with all of these movies that we discuss here on Cult Classics, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure can be found in both digital and physical formats. It's one of those rare movies that I saw the sequel, Bogus Journey, before this one. I'd heard it referenced in the playground, but I never saw it. It wasn't until the sequel hit cinemas and I'd seen it advertised on the back of comic books that I figured I'd give it a try. I enjoyed it, but not knowing the characters, it kind of went over my head. So I just went about my business. It wasn't until some months later that we hired the original from the rental store and everything clicked. I'm not sure if my impression was colored by the sequel, but I still wasn't that into it at first. It took me a while to come round, but I did and got into the original in a way that the sequel up until that point had left me cold. And the rest, pun not intended, is history. So, yeah, how about you guys? How did you first come to this one?
I can't specifically remember, but I do know that it was basically when the film was released, more or less. It would have been in around 1989, 1990. It was definitely well before Bogus Journey was even a thing. I just remember loving the movie, and it kind of, again, I can't remember why, how it was put in front of me or why, or what the reasoning was. It may have been a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy because the playground was abuzz with quotes from it. But for whatever reason, I ended up watching it, perhaps too young, 7 or 8 years old. It was one of, if not the very first film that I owned for myself on a VHS, a lovely gold box VHS I can remember having that I completely wore out. And I just loved it. I found it hilarious. I responded to it in whatever way, and it kind of became my personality for a while. You know, you just probably get annoyed the shit out of people just going around quoting it all the time for way too long.
Nice.
I can't remember actually seeing it at the cinema because I would have been in lower sixth form at the time, 16. My older brother and I got it from Blockbusters, probably just after it was released. When I started earning money, obviously I went and started buying a lot of my favourite films, and that was one of them.
Nice.
I saw this at the cinema. I was about 11, I think, at the time when it came out. But yeah, it was a good one because I obviously went with my family and stuff, and I think I was the only one that walked away and went, "That were cool." I enjoyed it, you know. It was a good one. And then obviously when it did come out on VHS rental, just I went through a phase of just watching certain movies over and over, and this was one of them.
Yeah. So yeah, how often, speaking of that, is it something that you watch regularly?
Well, I've watched it recently with my girls, and they sort of liked it but didn't really get it. Maybe I don't know, you know, it weren't really, didn't really catch the vibe, but then they enjoyed the sequel more than they did the first one.
Maybe it's that Reaper. Maybe it's the Reaper thing about it. Do you think it's a generational thing then, or
quite possibly? Because all the sort of dude and the sort of surfer talk, it were like, you know, like the sort of the way they talk to each other in the movie. I think it's a little, obviously completely different to what kids nowadays take to each other. They obviously just don't get it.
There's nobody in the movie shouting skibbity toilet or whatever it is.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and obviously no mobile phones, so, you know.
Oh, God.
Ted, yeah. You're on fleek, dude.
A phone box. What's a phone box?
What do you mean? Oh, my God. Yeah, what about you, Mike? Do you watch this often then?
Actually, yeah. I mean, like I said, I kind of wore it out when I was younger, and I just thought it was one of the best things ever because, I mean, you're young and you find things you like and you just, you know, that's what you do. And I didn't really realize, you know, there were hundreds of films out there in the world. Plus, I mean, again, at that age, I wasn't really going to be watching things that were like 15, 18 rated or R rated if you're in the States. So it was one of the few films that I think my parents would let me watch. Not that they were super strict, but they just knew there was nothing like hugely inappropriate in it, apart from, you know, Napoleon saying shit in French 20 times when he can't bowl, which I remember thinking was the most subversive thing in the world when I was like 7 years old. Like, oh, that guy did a swear. Oh, but it's in French. He got away with it. So, yeah. And then, so since then, it's one of those kind of feel-good films that if I'm having a bad day or I'm feeling ill or whatever, it's kind of a one of a series of 80s films that I'll just go, you know what, I'll chuck that on. It's not super long. It's very feel good. I always have fun with it. This and like Ferris Bueller's Day Off are the kind of main two, but there's a few other kind of 80s ones that that make the great 80s comedies that are very light.
What about you, Angela? Do you watch it frequently or is it, you know, just once in a kind of blue moon thing?
When I went to review it, because I was going to go through it last night and make notes and this, that, the other, I discovered that I'd only got a copy on VHS, but I haven't got a VHS player.
So it's been a while then.
Double around, order a copy from a certain wholesaler. It arrived earlier on today, so I've just watched it, finished watching it in the last hour. But I have watched it a few times in between, back when I still had a VHS player and whenever it came on telly, and there was nothing more enticing than that.
And I'll throw this on to anybody. Has your impressions changed since you first saw it? Because as I say, when I first, it just didn't click with me when I first saw it. It took me a while to come round. But what about you guys?
My opinions of it, my views on it are kind of a weird sort of graph. In that, like I said, when I first saw it, I thought it was the greatest thing ever. And so I absolutely adored it. And then for a while, I was kind of like film snobbish. And I was kind of like, well, I can't acknowledge this as a good film because, you know, it's a bit lightweight and it's not that heavy and it isn't, you know, Citizen Kane or whatever. And so, yeah, there was a time when I was like, I love it, but it's kind of, I don't know, I would keep it as sort of a secret shame, or I would say, oh, I like it, but it's only, you know, 3.5 stars, whatever. And then since, you know, recently-ish, I've just kind of been like, you know what? For what it is, it really is a blooming good movie. So I've kind of come back up to that point where I'm like, I was right to be obsessed with it. It does a lot of stuff brilliantly. You know, I'd be ashamed of it.
For me, it still remains a fun movie, you know, very light-hearted, enjoyable, not too heavy. You know, you don't have to think too much about, you know, what's going on. Pretty much there in your face. But this time watching it round, I'm struck by, why is it that nobody has commented on this bloody phone booth turning up in the middle of nowhere? For example, when it cuts off the water pipe, you know, the hose that Missy's using. Nobody mentions this, you know, the elephant in the room. The
great perception filter.
Out of nowhere. It's just like, it's a normality.
Well, yeah.
In that case, it's Missy. She's not exactly the sharpest tool in the shed, to be fair.
Well, I know, but as I say, it happens in all the various other places, like the Old West and whatnot.
So this, I don't know, John the Surf seemed pretty.
People wearing the strange clothes, and nobody bats an eyelid, more or less.
Yeah, I mean, fair it's enough. Cool, but I mean, obviously, you question a lot of things, like, you know, like, obviously, like you're saying, them travelling through time, taking these people from time, and it not really having an effect in the future. So it's kind of a little bit like, it's just a movie, obviously, you know, you just get on with it, but you kind of think along the lines of Back to the Future. If somebody,
it's like you people have never watched Doctor Who. He does that every other week.
Yeah,
true story.
That's what I'm saying. It's just a perception
with a phone box. Yeah,
turn up in a phone box, dressed really weird, pull somebody out of history. It's literally every episode of Doctor Who.
Yeah. You know, I'm sort of thinking that the phone booth was a bit of a nod to the TARDIS and Doctor Who.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Apparently, it wasn't. In an interview with Starlog magazine, Chris Matheson said he didn't intend for this to be a science fiction movie. And this is something I didn't know until doing the research. He says, I try to consciously fight it out of a desire to break away. But maybe I have a predilection toward that because of my father. This is what I didn't know. Matheson is the son of Richard Matheson, who wrote so many episodes of Twilight Zone, like Button and Nightmare at 8,000 Feet.
Yeah, didn't he also write I Am Legend?
Yeah. I was completely blown away by that.
Mild.
Yeah. Matheson said of the fantasy elements that emerged, he's a great writer and craftsman and always has suggestions. In fact, it was his father, Richard Matheson's idea that the time travel story beat own movie. Matheson said, we were going to write a sketch film with this as one of the skits, but my dad said, that sounds like a whole movie. And he was right. So, yeah, him and Ed Solomon wrote the script by hand on notepaper during a series of meetings at local coffee shops. They finished in 4 days. The 2005 box set, Bill and Ted's Most Excellent Collection, features some of their handwritten notes. In the original script, the time machine was a 1969 Chevy van. The filmmakers thought that was too similar to Back to the Future, so they changed it to a phone booth, and apparently neither of them had any clue that Doctor Who existed. Originally, the plot was to have Bill and Ted visit and accidentally cause all of history's greatest tragedy.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Including the sinking of the Titanic and the crash of the Hindenburg. No. Yeah, Bill and Ted actually began as a stand-up act from Solomon and Matheson, in which the characters would discuss current events without knowing what they were talking about. It's pretty much the news these days. It originally included a third character named Bob, but the comedian who played him lost interest after a few performances. So in the original outline for the movie, Rufus was a 28-year-old high school sophomore who befriended Bill and Ted. Originally as a spec script, the film was called Bill and Ted's Time Van. The core plot was similar, with Bill and Ted on the verge of failing their history class, ruining their plans to form a band. However, it deviated from the film version when they borrowed a van from their 28-year-old friend Rufus. And while driving the van, they end up in Nazi Germany. And after some hijinks, bring Adolf Hitler back to present-day San Dimas before continuing to collect other historical figures. Solomon said this approach became problematic, I don't know why, and Hitler was switched out with Napoleon in the final script. Other ideas in this draft were dropped included more involvement of Bill and Ted's classmates, including having them time travel with them, visiting Julius Caesar in the Roman Empire and ending up causing his death, and helping a prehistoric caveman invent fire so they could light up a joint. In earlier drafts of the script, other historical figures Bill and Ted plucked from history included Charlemagne, who they referred to as Charlie Mangy, Babe Ruth, and a non-famous medieval person called John the Serf, who is actually listed in the credits. I believe it's him that's calling them a heretic, saying they had fire in their eyes. In the book, The Producers, Profiles in Frustration, producer Scott Cope recalled pitching the script to Dino De Laurentiis. And according to Cope, Dino had no idea what the film was about. He didn't understand what dudes were until someone said to him that dudes meant guys who had big dicks. At which point he said, oh, great, now I get it. Ed Solomon and Matheson, they play the two annoying dudes in the ice cream parlor, the Ziggy Pig.
They're credited as ugly waiter and stupid waiter.
Yeah, I think what came out, it works. I don't think it would have worked with Adolf Hitler. I think the Hitler thing's been kind of overplayed in the intervening years anyway. But yeah, I think they did a tight little script there. Instantly quotable, as we all know. So yeah, what do you guys think with regards to the writing on this one?
Awesome. I love the dialogue. It's so iconic. You know, for those of us who lived in that era, none of us actually talked like that. But after seeing the film, everybody talked like that, for a few years at least anyway. It's not the best script in the world, but it is a fun ride. You know, it keeps you interested with all the various little twists and turns that they go through. You know, if you just ignore the obvious plot holes and things like that. But yeah, it's a very enjoyable film.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I think it captured the sort of demographic at the time, the sort of teenage, young kids' minds. It sort of fitted well in that respect. Because obviously, you know, when I watched it, I was like 11. So it fitted well and it struck a right chord with me, being a dude. So, yeah, I don't think it'd be too bad. I mean, you know, it's just a fun film, and it's not nothing, you know, it doesn't take itself too seriously, and neither should you.
Yeah, I mean, just to echo kind of what you were saying, I think it actually is a really tight script. I mean, the fact that it's only an hour and a half shows you that there's no, you know, mucking about or dawdling. It kind of just has to get straight to the point. But I also think it's a smarter script than it sometimes gets credit for, because the characters in it are portrayed kind of, or are seen as dumb because of the whole failing school and stuff and the whole slacker culture thing. But I do think it's a cleverer script than, like I said, some people realize when you think of how it combines all these historical figures and the way that they interact. And like I said, even the kind of the time travel paradoxy stuff, which would make Stephen Moffat proud, you know, the kind of the nonsense kind of, remember to do that. And then if we do that afterwards, then we'll remember to have done that. So it'll be here for us. And aha, we've done it yet. Kind of thing, you know, it's very on the nose with that. But I think other than, you know, regardless of any of that, I should say, I think one of the strengths of the film that's getting looked at more and more now is the overall kind of thematic core of like the idea of the power of positivity and friendship, and just a good message of like, we change the world through, whether it be through music or just that positivity and just that kind of, you know, be excellent to each other. It's not just a catchphrase, it's a philosophy, and it's become more and more one of those. You know, it's probably the best part of the third movie is when they kind of embrace that and everybody, you know, comes together with that idea. So I think there's that's another one of the reasons I think why it probably appealed to me as a kid, because it is the ultimate feel good movie. If you look at it that way, as like, this literally is positivity changing the future, which, my God, I wish that was true right now.
I think you're spot on with that. I mean, I don't know about you guys, and maybe I'm just a sentimental git, but you know, when they're doing the whole presentation at the end and then Lincoln steps up, I generally always get a lump in my throat. And there's not a single point where they bemoan each other's existence, or, you know, there's never, as you say, Mike, there's never any kind of negativity in that and in this. And, you know, you look at these guys and you think, all right, maybe there should be, because you're approaching it from this kind of cynical point of view, saying people like this, there's no way people are this kind of dense. I mean, obviously recent events have proved different. There's no way people are this dense, but they're not necessarily dense in, yes, they're not academically smart, but they do know their way around a problem, as you brought up when they're trying to get the characters out of the police station.
Yeah. I also think that, again, it's not really something they get a lot of credit for, but I think they're actually more emotionally intelligent and mature than pretty much anyone else in the movie, certainly more than like the ones that are portrayed as villains, like Ted's dad, who doesn't get anything. And it's just, I mean, without going into it, it kind of does that for you in the Freud therapy session at the end. It examines why he's basically such a dick to Ted and everything. But like, Ted and Bill are just like, they're not afraid to be optimistic. And, you know, just, they always support each other. They're always kind to each other. And with the exception of one really horrendous kind of, you know, homophobic slur, there's no real toxic masculinity on display. They're just kind of, they are who they are, and they're happy to be that way, you know.
I do think it's a good script, and I do think that the characterization, even the characterization of the historical characters, there would be a tendency to make them, you know, from some aspects, not be that great. But they're all kind of, you know, Bill and Tedified. They're more like they're larger than life. They're your stereotypical kind of take on the characters. And, you know, even when you've got someone like Genghis Khan, you know, you end up cheering him on in the sports store. Yeah, it portrays them all in kind of a positive light. And I do like that they've kind of all got this buddy comedy thing going on.
Yeah, I have to say what's the word I'm looking for? The chemistry between Socrates and Billy the Kid. It's just, ever since I watched it as a kid, I was like, those two could be a comedy double act. And it's not something I would have ever thought, like an ancient Greek philosopher and a kind of cowboy outlaw. And yet they have the best chemistry in the movie, other than Bill and Ted, obviously.
Yeah.
That is until you get Sigmund Freud turning up, boiling the fire.
Such a
nice job, Egghead.
I just love it. It's so stupid, but it's stupid in a really endearing kind of way. George Carlin was famous for saying that the difference between, say, him and, you know, someone like Andrew Dice Clay is that if you're George Carlin's comedy is always about tackling the authority figures, whereas Andrew Dice Clay is always punching downwards. And I think you've kind of got that in this movie because everybody's kind of punching upwards. There's nobody, you know, putting anybody else down. And it is an optimistic kind of outlook on the world. Some of the dialogue, it's aged a bit, but that's going to be from any 80s movie. But I think some of it still kind of sparkles. And I think with the performances as well, and I'm not necessarily just talking about the two leads. I don't think there's anybody in this that lets the side down. Everybody kind of, even if they didn't know what they were getting into.
Absolutely. And I think credit to the guy who played Napoleon, because we always say, you know, dying's easy, comedy's hard. And he had the really broad comedy to play, this kind of sort of stereotypical idea that Napoleon's kind of the spoilt brat. You know, I'm just going to eat all this ice cream for myself and I want to go on the water slide next and whatever. And he's genuinely hilarious.
I mean, Napoleon, I relate so to funny. That. I mean, that sounds like a fun time.
Yeah. The stuff in Napoleon's my favourite bit. So funny.
Oh, it's so good. And I mean, the cynical part of me was like, oh, a water park slide called Waterloo that Napoleon ends up in. And I'm like, it's a comedy. Of course Napoleon ended up at Waterloo. But you can't really judge these things. It's a comedy. It's supposed to be funny, you know?
Yeah, I think he plays it. I think he does a really good job. And I think it was you mentioned earlier when he's bowling and he's sliding down the lane going, shit, man, shit, man, shit, man. Shit. It's just fantastic. But you see that kind of like little pettiness throughout.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, just fighting over the ice cream and the whole thing where he's kind of like fudging with the bowling scores.
And, yeah, right, in the extra little digital.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'll get on to the acting. We'll get on to the acting now. And, in a 91 interview, Ed Solomon said the characters of Bill and Ted in the movie detailing their excellent adventures were originally envisioned as two 14-year-old skinny guys with low-rider bell bottoms and heavy metal t-shirts who were despised by the popular kids at school. Casting Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter changed the filmmakers' images of the characters because they said once you cast Alex and Keanu, who look like pretty cool guys, that's, you know, there's no way you can make them this like despised little weak characters. Stephen Herrick himself, he screened between 200 and 300 actors for the main roles, including Paulie Shaw, while River Phoenix, Sean Penn, and then apparently Brendan Fraser reportedly auditioned for Bill, although he's kind of denied it since. Reeves was one of the first to audition, and Herrick quickly identified him as Ted, making much of the rest of casting to find a match against Reeves. Some were called back and auditioned. On one of the audition days, Reeves was one of the first to arrive, along with Winter. And while waiting for the auditions to start, they found out they got a lot of personal details in common, such as interest in bass guitar and motorcycles, and quickly developed a rapport between each other, which earned them the title roles. A long-standing urban legend has it that Reeves auditioned for Bill and Winter for Ted, but according to Winter, the story emerged because the characters are so similar, even he and Reeves sometimes became confused about who was who. Yeah, through rehearsals, Winter and Reeves worked on developing their Bill and Ted characters to move them away from being the stereotypical comedic slackers and insert some sincerity and other more human elements into them. while they develop mannerisms outside of the script, influenced partially by comedians like Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan, the pair kept to the dialogue written by Solomon Matheson, with Winter calling it very floral, so paradoxical to how you think dumb Valley guys would speak. Winter said that to develop Bill's character, he borrowed from the looks and trends along Venice Beach, where he'd been living, including wearing a baseball cap backwards and pulling part of his hair through the opening. Yeah, Winter claimed that he gets two types of letters from teachers, positive ones from history teachers for encouraging students to learn about history, and negative ones from English teachers for affecting the way students speak. Alex Winter confirmed that the S in Bill S. Preston is Stanley.
They absolutely got the casting spot on with Keanu and Alex. The interplay between the two of them, the relationship on screen, it's evident how much fun they were having making this film, and that, you know, they were really into it. That just comes across.
Yeah, definitely. It's like you said, poorly sure. I mean, he had his moment, but I couldn't imagine him being in this movie. It'd be weird.
Yeah,
as an actor, do you know what I mean? He's not really a great fit.
I think as a partnership, they work really well, these two guys, and I don't think you could have asked for any better.
No,
I think that's a large part of why the movie works, is because they have genuine chemistry. To me, they seem like they're actually friends. I mean, I presume they get on. It seems like they've never really had bad words for each other. And yeah, like I said, they both commit well to the idea of they're both being this optimistic, positive force.
There's kind of like an innocence to them, a naivety that I think's really endearing for the characters as well. If they were kind of smart asses, you wouldn't be on board with them, I don't think, as much as you end up being. They kind of like muddle through a lot of the situations that they're in, but because of their, as you said earlier, Mike, their positivity, you generally root for them.
Keanu Reeves's physical comedy acting is really underrated as well, the way he's kind of got this floppy kind of persona, and he does a lot of the more physical kind of headbanging movements and stuff, and it's subtle, but it's really kind of, I think it helps really add to the humor of that character.
It's almost cartoon-like.
Yeah. There's one like little snippet that kind of stands out as that for me, where they're on stage at the end, they're with Socrates. Bill says, Ted is...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I'm going to do the translation for him. Mm. And Ted looks at him and then just goes, oh, well, and shrugs and just gets on with it. And you can see the look on Reeves's face as like being incredibly confused and then thinking, okay.
Yeah.
So apparently for years, Reeves, he lamented that his epitaph would be, here lies Keanu Reeves. He played Ted.
But then, like you said, look at like recent years when he expanded from The Matrix into like John Wick, even Speed, like not that long after Bill and Ted, you know. So I think he expanded himself, and I think it was perhaps wise for Alex Winter, not that he's any worse of an actor, but for him, he was never going to have that role. So he kind of became a really good director instead. Yeah. So, you know.
I did appreciate the little nod in Matrix, which got everybody, I can remember that, everybody in the cinema was laughing when Morpheus is trying to teach him to jump between the buildings, and Morpheus jumps and Neo goes, whoa. Yeah. So yeah, I think that they're really good. And I do think, yeah, Reeves went on to become obviously more famous than Winter, but I think Winter more than holds his own with Reeves in this. I do love the interplay between them. So yeah, which brings us to Rufus. And I don't know if you know this, but Arnold Schwarzenegger turned that role down.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
He won't be able to fit in the phone booth.
I cannot. I love Arnie, but I cannot imagine him as Rufus.
No, definitely cannot picture that at all.
It's the phone booth.
Would you mind if I jammed with you? In April 2013, Alex Winter called casting George Carlin a very happy accident. He says they were going after serious people first. Roger Daltrey, Ringo Starr, Sean Connery, and Charlie Sheen. I'm not sure where Charlie Sheen comes from in serious roles. And someone had the idea way after we started shooting of George. He says that whole movie was a happy accident because no one thought it would ever see the light of day. They didn't think that George Carlin would accept the role.
I think, again, he's a huge part of why it works. And I think he's possibly a part of why it feels like there's something really missing from the third movie.
Yeah.
Because he passed away by then. And I think you can't really replace him. He's so good. Even though in the movie he doesn't get that many lines, his impact is felt throughout, or at least he is to me, because he's just so... Because he's the straight man and the mental figure and the kind of guy you look up to, it's just he always had a screen presence for me. Yeah, even the few lines he gets are great. I mean, one of my favorite lines in the film is just literally turning to camera and going, "They do get better."
Yeah. I do like the little fourth wall break in that one.
Exactly, yeah. It's just, and like the narration at the start is by him. Like I said, the bit where he's like, you know, "Oh, this is San Dimas in the future. The air is clean, the roads are clean, the dirt is clean. You know, the golf scores are up, mini golf scores are down, or whatever." And it's like, okay, he's got the gravitas to pull that off. Even as a comedian, it's not ridiculous. And I can't see anybody else in that role, especially, like you said, the likes of Schwarzenegger or any of these comedy guys that we're going to get.
The only other person I would have imagined could have played that one would have been Dean Stockwell, just because of his role in in Quantum Leap.
Oh, yeah, it's a similar vibe.
He'd have fitted quite well, yeah.
Yeah, I'd never really noticed that one. So that's kind of a good little comparison. The three most important people in the Utopian Society, this is one I kind of would have liked to have seen. They were going to be envisioned by ZZ Top. However, Solomon had connections to Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, the Tubes and the Motels. So they were able to get Clarence Clemons, Fee Waybill and Martha Davis for the most important people. But I would have loved to have seen ZZ Top up there.
It would have worked, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Diane Franklin and Kimberly Cates, who played the princesses, also read for the role of Missy, and Diane Franklin read for Joan of Arc, respectively. I spoke to Diane Franklin last year, a great lady. Mm. And she informed me that the names Elizabeth and Joanna are incorrect. There was a mix-up in the credits where they were attributed the wrong name, and it's kind of been stuck as a mix-up ever since. And with regards to Bill's philosophy to Socrates, "All we are is dust in the wind, dude." It's a line from Dust in the Wind by Kansas, and Socrates' response is, "Like sands of the hourglass, such are the days of our lives." And for decades, that was the opening credits voiceover for the soap opera Days of Our Lives. Yeah, Amy Stark, who played Missy, went on to appear in Days of Our Lives, as did Socrates himself, Tony Stedman, who went on to appear in 15 episodes in 1990. There's quite a good cast, and you know, you've got people like Ken Leung, who is obviously known as Hollywood henchman from the 80s, who would appear in things like Die Hard and Big Trouble in Little China. You know, he's doing the same kind of things, but he's got more of a comedic role. And I think he works really well. I love when he's twirling the baseball bat around in the sports store. And then you've got people like Jane Wiedlin playing Joan of Arc. So, yeah, I mean, do you have any standouts, any... You know, disregarding the main three in this, which is Bill, Ted and Rufus, do you have any MVPs in this one?
Oh, no, I've already said, like I said, I think Socrates and Billy the Kid's chemistry is underrated. Napoleon as a petulant man-child is a really cool, well-played thing.
Yeah, I liked Napoleon's character. I thought he was hilarious. The other thing as well, they just seem to get around doing so many things, like bowling, he's gone to water park, then he's doing into ice cream parlour. It's like a full day out.
Yeah.
But then he gets kicked out of ice cream parlor. That was just hilarious.
For me, when I was growing up and watching it, I mean, I had a little bit of crush on Billy the Kid because I was into all things cowboys. But I have to agree, the absolute standout character for me is Napoleon, for all the reasons you've just mentioned. And he got into the water park. If you notice, there's a woman who plays for 11 children. And he ducks down, so he's the height of the children in front of him.
Yeah.
So that's how he gets in.
It was a short joke.
Yes.
And were you bringing up Billy the Kid? I mean, Dan Shaw, he's great in this. And mm-hmm. I didn't realise until we did the Tron review, he's Ram from Tron. But I think he's really good. And as you said earlier, Mike, I think the chemistry between him and Tony Stedman as Socrates, it's really funny in itself.
I'll be honest, like when it comes to Billy the Kid, I'm really pleased that they do Lampshade. And I'll probably slightly misquote it here. The idea that when they land at one of the destinations, I think it's Ted says, "I must say, Billy the Kid, you are coping with the severity of time travel most well, you know, most calmly." And I'm like, I'm really glad they said that, because I'd be wondering, like, is he not freaking the flip out about any of this?
Yeah, because like, no, doesn't he come out of the phone booth and go, excellent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bringing us on to direction, really. And I've only got a few notes on this. When Bill and Ted pick up Napoleon, the battle in the background, it's stock footage from War and Peace, the 1956 production. And the bar fight scene, it's apparently a parallel to the Girl Scout fight scene in Airplane. Both begin over a poker table. They have the same punches and the bar stool hit, and both end up with being slid across the bar and breaking through a wall, or in Airplane's case, the jukebox. On the cover of the British VHS re-release, I don't know if that's one that you've got, Angela, there's a picture of Bill and Ted wearing tuxedos, linking arms with the princesses. Apparently that image was taken from the high school prom scene, which was later cut out from the finished film. Apparently, the film ended with it's really weird, because apparently they chopped and changed it. The initial cut of the film was 2 hours and 20 minutes long and was pruned significantly. Initially, the film ended with Bill and Ted giving their report. I mean, this was in the draft, not the cut, but they ended up with giving their report with a small classroom, passing the class, and then going to the prom with the princesses. The production team felt this was just completely underwhelming, so created the auditorium presentation. One such scene filmed was a lengthy choreographed song number that would have started off the film with Bill and Ted dancing and air guitaring on their way to school, and then end up getting their asses kicked by some jocks once they arrived. Yeah, Winter found some stills from the filmed version of this scene on an old hard drive and shared them on the internet with some additional details on the production. Winter believed that Kenny Ortega had been involved in establishing the choreography based on the time period and his recollection. He said neither he nor Reeves could dance prior to shooting this scene, so the scene was rehearsed for roughly an hour a day across several weeks concurrent to other parts of filming. Winter identified other scenes that he recalled filming that had been cut, including the aforementioned prom scene, and a running gag involving the pudding cups and John the Surf character. Yeah, while they tried to find the film reels with this cut footage, Winter said that with the fate of DEG following the film, it's likely lost to time. So with regards to the direction, I don't know what you guys think. It's competent. I wouldn't say it's outstanding. There's some nice little touches. But there's nothing to me that really stands out with regards to the direction. So what about you guys?
I would beg to differ. I think it's actually really, when you think of how much it's juggling, I think it's actually really good. You're doing the time travel shenanigans, duplicate Bill and Ted's, multiple historical characters and locations, you know, the actual travel through the time circuits and stuff. The fact that it's got to have this rock and roll music video aesthetic almost at times, and there's so much happening at all times. I think I don't envy the director of it. And I'll be honest, I do think Stephen Herrick as a director does the best job out of all of the three Bill and Ted film directors, even though it pains me to say that, because Dean Parasot, who did the third one, is the director of Galaxy Quest and should be better.
It's definitely got a lot more going on behind the scenes. And I think if they sort of add an extended version of it, we could delve more into the sort of time travel stuff. I think one of the things that kind of confused me was like the whole Back to the Future. As he travels back in time, he literally appears where he went back in time. Whereas Bill and Ted seem to be able to travel to different countries in their time box.
Yeah, they dial it up on the little circuits of time directory thing, though. So that's
It's like the different area codes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's pretty cool.
I think, you know, I can't see anything particularly outstanding with regard to the direction. It is very good. close-ups where it's needed and then pulling back for the wider angles, like you say, using the historical footage from War and Peace, was it?
Yeah.
It is well put together, how it's been edited and directed. You know, it's nice, it runs smoothly, not jerking you about a lot and making you think, what on earth's going on? Yeah, I'd say it's just a good pace, great camera shots that they've chosen.
It does have, I will say this, I mean, I'm going back on what I said, it does have some nice staging in some shots, like the presentation, the bit where they go to the future. I think those, especially the one where they go to the future, I think it comes across as kind of really emotional. I don't know what you thought to that one.
I love that scene, and I've written under the, I think I had it under the writing, but we skipped past it, that I'd said, I really like that the script has them arrive in the future. And then it's almost an accident, but it happens at the perfect time in the movie when you need them to have this kind of awe and be aware of the stakes, for want of a better word. And I love those scenes completely. Yeah.
I it does have nice touches. I mean, like the part where they go for Joan of Arc, you know, Bill reaches out for her, and it's kind of reminiscent of the God
the
and
hand
Adam.
Of God.
Yeah. Mm. I think it's
absolutely.
Yeah. Nice. It's got some nice touches, but I, you know, it's one of those things that there's no shots to me that seem kind of grab you kind of thing. But again,
sometimes that's the best direction, though, isn't
it? Yeah, if a director's doing a good job, you don't even think about the staging a lot of the time. So,
and if I was to describe it to you, I mean, when you think of the way things are framed, and this is a random example that comes into my head, but when they're doing the aerobics class and it's just filmed straight on, and then Joan of Arc leaps in from sort of side stage. That gag doesn't work if you haven't framed that perfectly. You know what I mean? So, and there's a lot of comedy moments, I think, like that, where you would give the game away if you weren't doing it properly.
I'm gonna go back on that and think and say, yeah, I think I'm gonna agree with you on this one, Mike, which is unusual in itself.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
not the date and time.
So yeah, moving on, we'll go on to production design and. I think there's some really good stuff in here. I mean, all of the figures that Bill and Ted pick up through history, they're shown on the blackboard in the opening scene. But I mean, CG, when you're going through the circuits history, you can tell it's CG and it might not have dated as well as the rest. But in the context of the scene it's featured, it doesn't necessarily have to look hyper real. And to me, that works and holds up pretty well even all these years later. I don't know what you thought to that.
I always loved that as well, and I think it gets away with being surreal. That's the whole point, is that, like you said, we don't exactly have a frame of reference to be like, well, that doesn't look like the realistic times.
Well, exactly, yeah. According to Alex Winter, the filming in the phone booth, where they're all like, you know, kind of in that angle where it looks more like a roller coaster. Apparently, it was so unpleasant that he and Keanu Reeves nicknamed it the Death Box. So, yeah, that phone booth, it was given away as a contest prize by Nintendo Power Magazine, which was promoting at the time the Bill and.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy, just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Ted, excellent video game adventure.
That is the most 80s sentence I think we've ever said on the podcast.
It is, yeah. I wonder if the person still got that. I would not be parting with that for anything. The scenes at the Waterloo's water park are a combination of establishing shots at Raging Waters in San Dimas and shots with the actors at Golfland Sunsplash in Mesa, Arizona. Because of the limited budget, they could not close down the water parks for filming, and thus all those in the background of these shots were actually paying customers. to the water parks on those days. The Metro Center Mall in Phoenix, Arizona, which was used as the San Dimas Mall, closed down in June 30th, 2020, after 47 years in business. That entire sequence where they go wild in the mall, that's still a favorite. I don't know what you guys think to that one.
I absolutely loved it. I was really annoyed that they got the security guards to haul Beethoven off the keyboards, because, you know, that was a really great performance he was putting on there. And it really showcased this keyboard. So why is the store manager saying, like, let's get rid of this guy?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you've worked in retail, Angela. You know what it's like. After a while, you want those bastards out of the shop.
Yeah, but he was showcasing the keyboards excellently. You'd have thought that sales would have gone up after that.
I do remember, I know I was very young when I first saw this, but I do remember actually shouting at the screen at that point when I was watching on the video, because it's like, obviously, they're taking people out that are, you know, for Joan of Arc forcing you into the aerobics class, or Genghis Khan trashing the place. And when they come to take away Beethoven, I remember just shouting out, he's done nothing wrong!
Yes. Exactly.
He truly hasn't. He was given the, like, you know, if you're a musician, here's what you can do with these. Like, he was shown it by the sales guy. He's not doing anything wrong.
Meanwhile, Genghis Khan's trashing the store and Billy the Kid's running around shooting.
Yeah. How did they get away with Billy the Kid just shooting out a light in the whole school hall, by the way?
Oh, I was going to bring that up. That's an average day in America, isn't it?
I'm going to say America. America, dude. Yeah, I think it's a good sequence. Weirdly enough, I do find this funny. One of the TV commercials, which was promoting the movie back in 88, had George Washington lamenting on how he wasn't picked to go with Bill and Ted, but expects them to come by any time now, and they never do.
Because, you know, I'm a huge sci-fi nerd in particular. I remember from the first seeing this, just loving the way the future is depicted. You know, the fact that it's all kind of new and shiny, and again, the director films everything from down looking up, so it all has this sense of grandeur. And even just the really cool kind of the initial form of the time travel capsule, the kind of golden obelisk and the way it spins into the central control or whatever. It's like, oh, that's so cool. So good. But the only other thing I've noted is that, like I said, a lot of particularly lower budget comedies, which I think you could probably say this is, would just have the historical periods on a very obvious soundstage or whatever. And I don't get the sense from this, which, as you said, probably relates to the guys kind of copying Monty Python. I never question that they're in those time periods, and I'm never just like, well, if you walk over there, there's clearly going to be a stagehand or whatever, you know. So yeah, kudos to actually going to these, I assume, these locations to actually film Wild West and medieval England and wherever else, you know, ancient Greece.
I agree. They all look as if they have been filmed in that particular location, like ancient Greece. The castle, I was trying to find out where they actually filmed the castle segment. Yeah, it definitely looked genuine, you know, with the spiral stone staircase, things like that, with the ropes along the walls. These are all the kind of things that I'd be looking for that might get missed in a low-budget film. But all the things that I was expecting were there. So, yeah, they did really well on that. The only problem I've got with that medieval section is how the hell did they get the suits of armor on? Because it usually takes a team of people to put a knight's armor on them.
Well, it's kind of digs into my only plot hole in this, where Ted goes down the stairs and then falls out of that suit.
Yeah. That's not going to happen.
I knew you were going to say that.
That's
like the cartoon side of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was impressed with the production design, and my goodness, I can't imagine how much they spent on hairspray, especially for the bit at the end, you know, with all the teenagers in the auditorium. It's like,
oh God, one rogue flame in that place.
Yeah.
What about you, Ian? What have you got anything on the production design?
Just like everybody else, I mean, the actual, like you said, the sets and everything look proper spot on, and even the VFX stuff from the actual appearance of the time box coming in and out, it's almost the same sort of hand-drawn lightning bolt effects that's in, like, you know, like Big Trouble Little China.
Yeah,
they're sort of on par with that sort of level, and they still look pretty good now.
They do. I still have a sense of awe when that phone box, you know, first comes down outside Circle K.
Yeah.
And you know, when it leaves and you've got the little kind of like lightning effect circling where it was stood, I love that kind of little detail. Yeah, so we'll move on to sound design. And the composer for this one was David Newman, whose credits include Throw Mama from the Train, Critters, Hoffa, Flintstones, Jingle All the Way, Heathers, Honeymoon in Vegas, Brave Little Toaster, The Phantom, Nutty Professor, Anastasia, War of the Roses, The Kindred, Bowfinger, and The Mighty Ducks. For all of these credits, it's virtually unnoticeable in this film, because most of the time you're concentrating on the, you know, the actual tracks. I mean, he's a great composer, but he's almost, to me anyway, I mean, you know, your mileage may vary, he's almost invisible in this one. I wonder what you thought to that.
The Bill and Ted movies, all of them, they're so heavily reliant on actual like rock music that the incidental music gets completely lost, to the point that I think I read somewhere that you could get sort of soundtracks of the songs that are featured, but for like 20 years after the first movie, you couldn't get a soundtrack album of the score. Because like, that just gets lost.
Exactly. I can't see anybody coming out of seeing this movie and saying, I really want the score for that. You know, it's and the tracks on the actual soundtrack, I mean, they're so good and they're so pivotal, a lot of them, to what's happening on screen. I'm thinking, you know, the aforementioned Big Pig when the capsule's coming down at the start, Extremes Play With Me when they're at the mall and that entire chaos sequence is going on. Walk Away by Bricklin, which is the music that they start introducing the history presentation with, and Robbie Robb's In Time, where that entire future sequence, and obviously The Two Heads Are Better Than One by Power Tool. You know me, I'm a sucker for a soundtrack, and this is one of those that's been on my kind of playlist or phone for years.
For this one, I don't think any one particular track stands out other than Carlin's solo by Stevie Salas, who, incidentally, it's his hands you see playing the guitar instead of
Rufus.
Yeah, that is probably the standout for me. You mentioned Two Heads Are Better Than One, so a little bit of a link from that soundtrack to the soundtrack for Bogus Journey. One of the writers of Two Heads Are Better Than One is Dweezil Zappa, son of Frank Zappa, who, of course, had the Mothers of Invention. One of the previous members of the Mothers of Invention was one Steve Vai, who goes on to write The Reaper and the Reaper app for Bogus Journey.
Oh, my God, that was like musical 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, so there you go. That's a little bit of trivia for you. And if you do watch the Blu-ray of Excellent Adventure, there is actually an interview with Steve Vai.
Yeah,
that was fun.
Cool.
I like the intro to a film, like the music that plays in the intro, like on the credits. Because it's one of them things, it's like some movies, I kind of skip the credits scene, but like this stands out a bit more because it's like a decent track. And like you said, Two Heads Are Better Than One's a good one. But yeah, there's quite a few. Boys and Girls Are Doing It, that's quite a good one.
Oh, yeah. During the water park scene.
Yeah. Pretty much they're all decent. And like even the second one, I mean, you know, I bought the soundtracks for both. Like you said, the orchestral stuff always gets lost in the mix. Yeah. It's a film that features, you know, a lot of rock tunes.
Yeah, so we'll move on to the legacy of this thing now. And obviously, as we've said, there's been two sequels, 1991's Bill and Ted Bogus Journey and 2020's Bill and Ted Face the Music. What were your thoughts with regards to those?
I loved Bogus Journey. I still like it. I think that's... I'd watch that one over the first one. Even though I still like the first one, I just like the whole death character and all the station and all that sort of stuff. It's just mad. But yeah.
And the third one,
music. Oh, God, yeah. Cringe fest all the way through that. You could tell they tried so hard to try and reclaim the sort of what they used to do, and it just didn't work.
I was looking forward to that one. And
me too.
I was really kind of forcing myself to like it. But
I think I'll watch it again because obviously whenever you watch a film for the first time, it's like when they do sequels to stuff and they're on about doing Goonies and all this stuff, and I'm like, oh, please. But, you know, I'll give it another chance and I'll give it another watch. Maybe it's better than what I thought initially because I was just my frustration of how annoying it were.
With the colourful characters that you had in the first one and the even more colourful characters that you had in the second one, I think everybody went into the third one expecting more. It was especially a come down because after the second one, after the way the second one ended, that was pretty much the end of the story. So you're already on thin ice.
I have to agree with that. Yes, I think The Bogus Journey is much better than the third one. It was enjoyable, but it was lacking the original spark between the two actors, although they do still get on, as far as I understand. They just couldn't recapture the original interaction that they had. It seemed forced.
Yeah. I think, for want of a better term, and it's going right back to what was said at the start, it's the first one, and to an extent the second one, even though things took a bad turn, they had this kind of positivity about them that anything was kind of possible. Whereas the third one, I think the tone completely changed. And you've got two guys that were basically reminiscing about their life and how bad things had turned out. And I don't think it suited the tone of the franchise.
They left it too long. It's so quintessentially like 1989 and 1992 that then you leap to 2020 and it's just like, you've left it too long. You can't. It's now divorced from the era where it worked. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And also the special effects are not as, I mean, even though technically they're better visually, they're not as good.
It didn't. There was no sense of awe. There was nothing to really grab you in that third one. And I think
the bit in the, at the end, I thought it was the closest they got to it, where it was like everybody in the world was playing this music on their guitar, and it showed you an attempt to show you like everyone, and it was like holograms of different people lined up against the road, as I recall. And I was like, yeah, all right, this is kind of cool. This is close to something. But then for every bit like that, you've just got nonsense Bill and Ted in old age makeup farting around in an old people's home, and I'm just like, just stop it.
Yeah. The only thing that I will say, and I've still not been able to find it, so I couldn't say if
I was going to mention, like, somebody was in that end bit, weren't they?
Somebody was in that end, ooh, in those end credits, yes. But I've still never been able to find it. So if you can find it. Yeah, but yeah, apparently I'm in the end credits somewhere. But I think it's a diminishing returns. Would you, sir? I mean, we've had this conversation before, Mike, with regards to franchises. Do you think this would have been better left alone as a standalone, or do you think you could have maybe stretched a Bogus Journey and then just leave it at that?
I like Bogus Journey a lot, but it's not. It's almost a different genre of movie. Like it veers away in my opinion, the smartness and the cleverness of the script in favor of just embracing kind of slapstick and ridiculousness. And it's like saying, you know, oh, I'm comparing an episode of, I don't know, Fawlty Towers to The Mighty Boosh. Like, they're both comedies. I enjoy them both, but they are not the same tone. Do you know what I mean? It's, one is quite smart and one is just surreal for the sake of it. And yeah, I think when it comes to Bogus Journey, I loved it when I was younger, and I still think it's a good movie. It's just not a patch on the first one, because I remember reading in the behind the scenes stuff, they were struggling to make it work. And there's a story that I think is quite indicative of the movie for me, which is that the robot station thing is called Station because they were writing up a script and there was a scene that they had cut that was internal police station, and they deleted it, but they'd left the word station on the like typewriter or word processor or whatever. And it was so late at night and they were so kind of, you know, high on whatever they were doing and so exhausted that they were just wandering around going, ooh, station, 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 and thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And I'm like, yeah, probably was at like 2 a.m. when you've had no sleep and you're trying to write a movie, but it's not particularly funny otherwise. Do you know, yeah, you're just left with the baffling question of, why is it called that?
Do you think it kind of went too far off track?
Yeah, I mean, there's no time travel in the second one, and that's kind of, it's a key ingredient of what I think I liked about it, which is, you know, as much as I think the third one doesn't work, at least it attempts to bring the time travel element back into it, which the second one just completely abandons, more or less.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You know, in favor of like, we're doing a metaphysical journey through the afterlife instead. And it's just like, why? You were a sci-fi film, not a fantasy movie. What are you doing?
I know. I kind of like the direction they took it in the second one. I think they tried to make it a little bit more serious, but not too much, and like a bit of a darker undertone with it, with obviously the deaf character and whatnot. Yeah, it worked for me. I mean, I liked it, but I didn't, not so keen on the third.
Fair enough. Angela, what would you go? One,
I
two,
would
or
agree
three?
With Ian. I really enjoyed Bogus Journey, even though it wasn't, like you said, the time travel element to it. Some films, some sequels, it's basically like a rehash of the first. And I got the feeling that with Bogus Journey, they didn't want to just do the, oh, let's go through time travel again.
And
you know, tried doing something different. So for me, that worked. But Face the Music, they left it too long. You know, the chemistry is not the same. I don't think the plot was very well written either.
I do think the plot of the third one looks good on paper. I just think they didn't execute it particularly well. Because I was looking through like the Wikipedia pages yesterday for the sequels, because I'd watched this one, obviously. And I was like, when you read the synopsis like briefly of the plot of the third one, and it cuts out all of the crap and the unnecessary scenes and just breaks it down, I'm like, this could have been a good movie, but I feel like they just mucked it up in the filming somewhere.
It did take place during the pandemic and stuff, so...
Yeah.
You don't know how much that kind of affected it. It's...
Yeah, completely. But I'm not averse to the idea of them having daughters and them taking over the legacy and whatever. And like, I'm fine with all that kind of idea. It makes sense that you've left it this long anyway, that you can't really, like you said, if you don't do that, you're just left with Star Trek VI as Bill and Ted moan about how they're, you know, saving the galaxy is a game of the young. And oh, we're so very tired. Nobody wants to watch that for 2 hours.
Yeah. There were two spin-off TV series, both titled Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures. The first one was an animated series that ran on CBS in 1990, which featured the voices of Winter, Reeves, and Carlin returning to the roles. A second season of 8 episodes ran on Fox Kids with the voice cast of Fox's then upcoming live-action series, which is, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures. It ran for only 7 episodes on Fox in the summer of 92. It didn't feature any of the film cast, and instead Evan Richards and Christopher Kennedy played Bill and Ted. Has anybody seen the live action one?
Once and never again. I think I put it out of my memory. Although I do love the animated one, and by the way, fantastic theme tune, which has been in my head ever since 1991 or whatever when I first heard it.
I've not seen any of that, so I'm going to have to check that one out.
At the very least, check out the theme tune to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures. It's one of those kind of, you know, it's a rocking kind of catchy theme tune that once you hear it, it's going to be there forever in your brain.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, in 2010, the city of San Dimas, California, celebrated 50 years of incorporation. The celebration slogan was San Dimas, 1960 to 2010, an excellent adventure. So, I do like they fully bought into that. The punk band The Ataris wrote a song based on Ox's report titled San Dimas High School Football Rules, but other than that, it's got nothing to do with the movie. Steve Jackson Games released a Bill and Ted Excellent Board Game in 2016 based on the movie characters. DC Comics produced a tie-in comic following the plot of the first movie, timed to coincide with the film's release on home video. The sequel was adapted by DC's competitor Marvel and published to coincide with the second movie's release in theatres. Its popularity led to the ongoing Marvel series Bill and Ted's Excellent Comic Book by Evan Dorkin, which lasted for 12 issues. So, it did better than the live-action show. There was a weekly two to four-page kind of adaptation of the animated series, and that was published for a year by the now-defunct UK magazine Lookin. And that was from 91 to 92. There were also Game Boy, NES, Amiga, Commodore 64, PC, and Atari Lynx video games released, which were very loosely based on this one, the original's plot, and that's what I believe ended up leading to that promotion where they gave the phone booth away. I mean, it's obvious that even all these years later, it's still got a hold on popular culture thanks to the quotable dialogue, memorable characters. Would you be up for Cena? I can't see it happening now, especially after the lackluster performance of Face the Music, but you know, inevitably, it comes to talks of a remake these days. Would you be interested in that, or do you think it was kind of lightning in a bottle for its time?
Yeah, no, I think it's. I would put this on the same kind of place as Back to the Future, where it's like it was fantastic for the time. Trying to update it into a modern setting is just not going to work. I don't think.
Leave it where it is.
Because the 80s was such an iconic era, and with it coming out in the late 80s. I think it is a film of its time and should remain that way. It didn't work bringing it into modern era. So I think if they did try and do a remake, I probably wouldn't want to go and see it.
Is it something for just our generation, Ian? You mentioned that you got your, you know, you were showing it to your girls and it didn't kind of grab them as it did our generation.
Yeah they weren't too bothered about it. It was like... Definitely like a generational thing. I mean, you know, just leave it alone. Come up with something original, do another time travel film, whatever. Just no point sticking Bill and Ted in it. You can't come up with an idea, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just stupid. Just leave it be.
When you look at what it is, though, Bill and Ted are such 80s kind of, they're our youth kind of culture stereotypes. And you say nobody talked like that, which they didn't really over here until it kind of spread here. But in America, that kind of Valley Girl slacker thing was happening. And like you said, if they were to try and update it for a modern audience, we'd probably hate it because it would just be like going around going, oh, skibbity toilet, dude, you're on fleek and whatever. And we'd just be like, fuck this.
There's some young people catching a clip of the show now going, look, listen to these old farts.
Yes, yeet them out of here.
Yeah. So, yeah, before we move on, is there anything that any of you wanted to bring up but you've not had the opportunity? Anything you think we might have missed?
I kind of like the thing in the first one at the end where they're still shit at playing.
Yeah.
And he kind of goes, better. They do get better. Yeah. that kind of tickled me.
Yeah, I mean, my favourite aspect of this, is the thing that keeps me coming back, it's just fun. You don't feel like you're on a, you know, and again, pun not intended, adventure with characters written for a movie. To me, it feels like you're hanging out with friends, and that's why I always keep coming back to this one. So what is it about this movie that makes you guys come back?
Like you say, it's almost like sort of revisiting friends that you sort of, you know, used to see all the time. And it's kind of like watching that. It brings about those memories. And it's a fun movie. You know, it's an easygoing sort of thing. And like I've said a lot of times now, it's like movies that are made nowadays are just bloody on for too long. It's like, just make a movie that's like short and sweet, straight to the point, does its thing. And there you go, you've enjoyed it.
Good. You don't need a packed lunch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or a toilet break halfway through.
Yeah.
It's like the movie version of putting on your favourite slippers, getting a cup of hot chocolate, and, you know, sitting and getting all nice and comfortable. You know, nothing bad is going to happen.
Yeah.
I
think we all kind of need
nice,
that right
comfortable
now.
Place to return to.
Yeah. So, yeah, as always, we asked what you out there thought about this one. So before we continue, we'll go over to Vian to hear your opinions. Come on then, Vian, what do the listeners say about this one?
Hey, DK. So, yeah, lots of love for the iconic duo Bill and Ted, but some people did have, you know, some comments that maybe not a 5 out of 5. So let's dive into it. Carnivius on Blue Sky says, I don't know. There's a lot of young reactors who have discovered Carlin because so much of his later, in particular, comedy is still so damn relevant to this day because nothing much has changed and in some cases has gotten worse. Super fun movie, but yeah, the word after the hug is jarring. And Crozzled Hearts replies, that's exactly why I was surprised my Z-ers didn't know him. His work is timeless but extremely relevant in the current moment. What also struck me on this rewatch was how dialed back Carlin was as Rufus. Based on that role, you'd hardly expect him to be the subversive comic voice of a generation, which he was. And then, Rufus is quite chill, but then Carlin is quite laid back in the interviews I've watched too. Movie Sky on Blue Sky. I love these movies. I realize that I'm probably one minority on this, but I think Bogus Journey is better than Excellent Adventure. It's so creative and interesting. Crossed Hearts, again, rewatched on New Year's Eve, and it really holds up. There's one unfortunate homophobic punchline, but otherwise, it's about as durable of an 80s teen com relic as they get. I did have to educate Gen Z about the significance of Carlin as Rufus, which made me realize that his work hasn't bridged the gen gap. Too long, didn't read. 4 out of 5 stars, mostly excellent. Quick aside to our younger audience members or the parents of younger audience members, do introduce them to Carlin. He was a genius. And yes, he crossed the line a couple of times that I'm aware of, but really important, not even satire, but really important work he did. When you present comedy as art and hold a mirror up, I think that's a really great way to radicalize people. So do introduce your kids to Carlin. Facebook Northeast Retro Den Nerd. James Gardner says, a most excellent experience. Rufus rocks. And remember, be excellent to each other. Hey, that's how I was going to end this. He stole that from me. Ray Kelly, definitely most bodacious. Great 80s flick. Tons of fun. Kick-ass music. Dave Moreland, love that movie. Noah's wife, laughing face. Gavin Revitt on Blue Sky, a great film. Seemingly quite a niche thing in the day. Almost overlooked. Very quotable and legendary amounts of fun. So, yeah, people really did enjoy it. But as you say, there are things from the 80s that don't hold up. There's things from any generation. But I think in the 80s, there was a lot of what we would now call problematic content. And as these reviewers say, as far as 80s comedy films go, this is one of the more tame ones in terms of content that has not stood the test of time in the PC world, shall we say. So, most excellent. And back to you, DK.
Excellent. Thank you, Vianne. And once again, thank you to you out there for joining in on this one. As always, if you missed out, just hit us up on our socials or in the comments below and let us know what you think of today's movie. Now, normally, we'll go straight into our final thoughts on the movie, but as I mentioned, last year I spoke to Diane Franklin, who played Princess Elizabeth, or is it Joanna, regarding her time on the movie. And if you want to see the full interview, we'll make sure the link to that is in the description, so please check it out. She's a great person and, well, still have a bit of a crush, to tell the truth. But honestly, it's an interview, technical issues aside, I'm pretty proud of, so yeah, please do go and check that out. Now it's time for us in here to sum up what we think. And if you've been with us before, you know the drill. And if you haven't, well, you'll get the idea. So, yeah, I'll come to you first this Ian. What's your final thoughts and score for Bill and Ted?
Definitely give it a 4.5. Definitely a timeless cult classic. Great music, you know, authentic chemistry between Bill and Ted. Overall, just an enjoyable movie.
It's a most bodacious film. It's a really enjoyable film to come back to. Yes, some bits didn't age quite as well as others, you know, especially as we mentioned the homophobic slur. So it's only for things like that that I would, I think I'll go with the same with as Ian, 4.5 out of 5.
Fair enough.
It is a film that on the surface is completely silly. Perhaps that's why it appealed to my younger sensibilities, but beyond just goofiness, it has a simple yet effective structure, a plot that's easy to follow but consistently entertaining, genuinely funny, and yes, even pretty clever. The silliness works because the film treats its ideas earnestly, never losing sight of the fun or its tone. Equal parts charming, wholesome, and occasionally even educational, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure ultimately carries a message that resonates just as much today as it presumably will 700 years from now. At a brisk 90 minutes, it's perfectly paced with absolutely no wasted moments, using its time travel premise as imaginatively as any sci-fi film. It's not deep, but its heart is completely in the right place. It's infinitely quotable, irresistibly feel-good, at least for me, and remains the purest and best use of the Bill and Ted IP and its ideas. It almost feels unfair to nitpick, but suspension of disbelief is stretched to breaking point at times. There's a touch of dated sexism and parts of the script feel slightly rushed, but for what it is, this comes so close to perfect that those criticisms barely matter. It continues to mean a lot to me personally, and I have to say, the film is most triumphant. I actually gave it a 5 out of 5. Ooh. After debating back and forth. I was going to go with 4.5 or 5 or somewhere in between, and I was like, you know what? For what it is, I think it's a 5 out of 5 for me.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's dated a little since its release, but for the most part, it's just a slice of the 80s, and I'm not going to get all pretentious on it because, I mean, some films are just meant to be fun, and what was probably just a throwaway movie for the studio turned into something that endures to this day with a certain generation, with two lead actors with an incredible chemistry. Minor nitpicks aside, I just love it. I always have a good time, and sometimes hanging with friends and having a good time is all you need. Excellent. But I've also given it 4.5. So, yeah, by tallying those up, putting everybody's score together, it gives Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure a final cult classic score of 4.6. 2 out of 5. So we'll just stick to 4.6. Let's not just go over it. So, yeah, I mean, I wasn't expecting much else other than being in the top echelons of scores. So, how about you lot? Are you happy with that? I know you gave it 5, Mike. Are you a bit disappointed that everybody else didn't?
No, not really. Like I said, I was debating because there are things that I could potentially pick fault with, but like I said, it was more that I let my own personal feelings override it.
So, yeah, once again, we reached the end of another episode of Cult Classics. Thank you to you, dear listeners, for hopping on board for this one. Hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please know we still have some good stuff to come in the latter half of the year, so feel free to come with us. Just hit that like button, followed by the subscribe button. Go on. You know, it makes sense. I'd just like to give thanks to our guests for giving us their valuable time on this one. So I'll start that off with Angela. Thanks, mate.
You're more than welcome. Anytime.
Nice one. You enjoyed it today?
I certainly did, yes. Most excellent.
Good. Good. Where can people find you? Any social media that you'd like to share with listeners, you know, and tell you you're wrong on any of your thoughts today?
Well, there's the usual links that I'm sure you put in below when you post this episode, so just go to those. The one thing I will say is I am no longer on that site that is run by Muscolini.
One of us. Cool. So yeah, Ian, how about you? You had a good time today, fella?
It's been most excellent. Definitely, yes.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for joining us, mate. Where can the listeners find out more and follow you? Anything special coming up?
Like I said, I've been recording some songs and stuff, some cover tracks, a lot of Robert Williams stuff. I've got my SoundCloud, TikTok, and YouTube.
Well, I'll get those in the description for both
thanks.
You and Angela.
Yeah,
no worries, mate. So, yeah, you out there, please do check those out if you're so inclined. And speaking of links, we'll be flashing up the ones for Silver Screen and all other Media Matters podcasts momentarily. But with that in mind, Mike, do you have anything to add regarding the coming months? Anything for people to watch out for?
No, just keep an eye out. I've got something on the schedule every week, more or less, either on Silver Screen, regular or classics. And you've got Cult Classics as well to come. So it's going to be very busy here on the Silver Screen podcast or over on Hit or Miss Who Trek. If you're a fan of Doctor Who or Star Trek, there's always going to be one of them running. So.
Well, again, allow me to thank you for joining us today, fella.
Oh, anytime.
So, yeah, we'll be back once again next month, as much as one can plan these things with the current state of the world. Man, we really do need to Bill and Ted in this reality. So, we'll be looking at another classic that heavily features music, though quite a bit different from this one. Yes, we'll be going all automatic, systematic, hydromatic, problematic. I'll once again be joined by Mr. Mike Wilson, along with returning guests Adrienne and Rune. As well as a very special guest. And we'll be taking a look at a cult classic from the 70s. So if you want to come with us and see what the word is, well, and consider this your invitation. As I said, just click like and subscribe, and we'll be here for you next time. Until then, take care of yourself. Don't let the bastards grind you down. And remember, be excellent to each other. And
party on!
Party on, dudes!
Party on, dudes!
It kind of worked.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Created, written, and hosted by DK. Editing by Nick. Produced by Mike Wilson. Feedback section produced by Lady Vienne. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. This has been a Mad Badger production for the Media Matters Podcast Network, copyright 2024. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.